Yeah, thank you. Well, welcome, ladies, gentlemen, Boltzmann brains, whoever. I won't proceed soon to distinguish whether you're a real ordinary observer of Boltzmann brains. Anyway, it's nice to be back here in Santa Barbara and KATP. So, well, as most of you know, the measure problem is one of the most severe problems in theoretical cosmology today. Is how does one make statistical predictions for observations in a universe so large that almost all observations actually occur somewhere? So you might want to take the fraction of observers of observations of one kind versus another kind, but even the fractions may be ambiguous if the numerator and the denominators are infinite. So it's a problem with, well, for open universes where it's infinite, and even for closed universes if you have eternal inflation. So there's many proposals for regulating these infinities, but none seem to be ideal to me. I'm going to give maybe a partial solution, but I'm not, even mine it has problems, so it's not ideal, but hopefully maybe there's a part of the proposal that might become incorporated into something. Okay, well, this is motivated, as some of you might recognize, by the Boltzmann brain problem, or at least that's one motivation for this. The quantum field theory suggests, maybe doesn't prove, that each region of space-time large enough for a human brain has a probability of, well, there's different ways you can calculate it, but one way is to say just it's a fluctuation. You've got a brain, and then you move the antimatter out from the brain, so it's separated by about a foot or something, and then just calculate the action of that, e to the 10 to the minus 42. If you don't believe that, you could say, well, all right, we're in de Sitter space with de Sitter temperature, and what's the Boltzmann factor for thermal production of a brain? I mean, then it'd be 10 to the minus whatever, 69 or some bigger number. But it's e to the minus that, so it's very, very tiny. So I don't really believe that the probability is high that any of you are Boltzmann brains, but it's still, if the universe lasts forever, then you have a tiny number multiplied by infinity, and this would give an infinite number of Boltzmann brains, and they would occur and presumably make observations. I mean, I'm assuming that if you get a brain in the same configuration that our brains are, it'll have the same awareness that our brains have. So now, if you regulated by saying taking per co-moving volume, so there'd be a finite number of galaxies per co-moving volume, then presumably only a finite number of ordinary observers, since presumably we can't last forever in this universe if the stars burn out and so on. So then there would presumably be an only finite number of ordinary observers. But then if you carry this co-moving volume infinitely far into the future, there'd be an infinite amount of volume, and infinity times this will still give an infinite number of Boltzmann brains. So it would swamp by that. Yes?
What's the matter with the simple-minded sort of way of dealing with Boltzmann brains? Let's assume we're not a Boltzmann brain. We actually have 13.7 billion years of history.
Okay.
And then we make predictions on the basis of that. And those predictions are confirmed, right, by observation. We make a whole succession of them in a way they wouldn't be with Boltzmann brains, right, because you presume the next observation of a Boltzmann brain will be not consistent with the previous one. So gradually you get confirmation of this theory that we're not a Boltzmann brain, and we don't have to worry about any of these other things.
Well, the basic idea is to make a theory in which our observations don't have negligible probability. I mean, we do want a theory for that. So I'm not in any way proposing that in reality Boltzmann brain dominates. It's just that we do want a theory that's like what you say. And I'm just saying there's the danger that quantum field theory, ordinary quantum field theory with a space-time that lasts forever, at least naively, without doing some regularization, seems to violate this. So, you know,
why do you assume that our observations are highly probable? I mean, that's like saying the whole structure of fundamental physics is designed, right, to make us, wave function of Hamiltonian, is designed to make us, right, highly the most probable things.
Well, no, I'm not saying we're most probable, but I'm saying the probability shouldn't be zero. And then I guess it shouldn't be very small. I mean, if you consider all, well, I'll talk about that, about
the probability evidently isn't zero if you believe in our theory.
Well, I mean, so far, Don isn't saying that we're Boltzmann brains. He's just saying that in the future, Boltzmann brains may dominate.
Yeah, so we're here living in the beginning, early universe, right, compared to this distant future. So there are a lot of Boltzmann brains out there. Who cares?
Well, there's this sort of Copernican principle problem.
Somehow
we're living in this really special time in the universe if you do it that way.
So much for the Copernican principle.
Yeah, so in some sense, I am assuming, I mean, this is something that Jim and I have been discussing about typicality and probabilities and stuff, and I'll get to it a little bit.
What the problem is? There's a problem.
Well, I guess the problem is here is if you have far more Boltzmann brains than ordinary observers, and if you imagine that you randomly choose that.
What's this presumably only a finite number of ordinary observers? Why are we assuming that?
Well, this is per co-moving volume. I'm assuming that, okay, if you fix the co-moving volume, you evolve the galaxies forward and stuff, that stars will eventually die out and there won't be any more ordinary observers like us. That we'll die out.
So you're basically assuming we sort of expand forever and we become decidic. Right.
But yeah, yeah. So we
cosmological constant dominates forever. So for example, if things turn around and become a big crunch, this problem disappears.
Yeah, the problem if the universe crunched, if it crunched with certainty with a time maybe less than 10^42 years, then we wouldn't have this. We wouldn't have this problem. So it's really a problem if the universe lasts. Well, it can be a problem for a no-boundary wave function, but that's a separate story. But if you assume that the wave function is dominated by Big Bang, then it would only be a problem if the universe lasts too long.
The problem basically is that you're presuming biobrains can't last forever, but Boltzmann brain fluctuations could go on indefinitely as long as the universe does. So then the question is, why don't we see ourselves as one of them as opposed to being biobrains, which is what, according to Jim, we presumably are.
Right, right. Yes. Yeah, it's basically at least simple-minded ways of doing the theory. Now, I mean, there are ways other people have done other ways of regularizing it to get around this. So I'm not saying it's definitely a problem, but at least a naive way of regularizing, just taking co-moving volume, extending off the future, you get, infinitely more Boltzmann brains than ordinary observers. You get a finite number of ordinary observers, an infinite number of the other. Therefore, the problem, if you just chose an observer at random or an observation at random, the probability that it would be an ordinary observer would be zero.
So let's assume we're atypical, right? And then that assumption is confirmed by successive observations.
Right, so that of course raises the problem. If you assume we're atypical, then it becomes very difficult to test theories. I mean, I could show, if I had a many worlds picture that all possible outcomes, say from tossing a coin, are true, and I threw a coin a million times, and I got a million heads. Well, you could say, well, quantum mechanics predicts there's some amplitude for that, so we have no basis for rejecting the theory that we have a fair coin with quantum mechanics. So I prefer to use a theory in which we can actually, I would prefer that we have a theory. Maybe we don't have it yet, but we have a theory where we really can calculate probabilities for observations, and we can use those as likelihoods for theories, and we can compare different theories by this.
Don, since everybody's asking a question,
right?
Maybe I would ask a question I didn't dare to ask from the beginning.
Okay.
It's so elementary. Why should I trust that number? And does your talk depend on that number? Suppose that I make that number a lot smaller.
Well, it doesn't. Yeah, for this point, it only depends on this number being non-zero.
Suppose I take that number and raise it to power of 10^100 or something. Then is there still a problem? I want to know at what point is there a problem? How small does that number have to be?
It's the same size
before
the
number,
if you raise it to 10^100.
Right. Well, okay. if you imagine that our universe is going to go on forever.
Yeah.
Then infinity, and suppose you do assume that even it goes on forever, that the stars burn out, so there's only a finite number of ordinary observers, and use this way of regularizing, which maybe people wouldn't accept, then you would get a problem as long as this number is different from zero.
So,
now it is true, and because string theorists tend to say the universe is going to decay away anyway with some exponent with e to the plus maybe 10^100 120, well, some number less than 122. It might be if the whole universe decays away before the volume, the space-time volume of the total universe times this number dominates over ordinary observers. So it's true. If you push this number down so small that the universe would decay away before any before a large number of Boltzmann brains form, then you wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah. So I want to know quantitatively, where's that threshold? How small does that number have to be?
Well. That of course we don't know, because we don't know exactly what the rate at which the universe is decaying. So and in fact that was one solution. I don't think I was going to mention it today, but that was one solution that I proposed, is that if the universe has a decay rate such that it would probably decay within 20 gigayears, then that would solve the problem.
Okay.
So anyway, so you could say that's a prediction, and it would be, you know, if people at CERN find that the masses and that the properties of the Higgs and other things are such that it predicts the universal decay within this time, well, I'd be elated, because I'd made some first time I'd ever made a prediction that's confirmed by anything. But but I'm not betting my life on it. I mean, I'd be rather surprised that they actually find the universe is going to decay in 20 gigayears. Yes.
I know you want to get on beyond slide one, or two maybe. But does it matter that they're brains? I mean, you could have Boltzmann bodies, Boltzmann planets, Boltzmann solar systems, Boltzmann galaxies. They can fluctuate as well, albeit with much smaller probability. But if they did, they can go on forever too. But observers in a Boltzmann galaxy would think they're bio-observers too, right?
Yeah, they would. Well, that's, I suppose, right.
At least I would.
Yeah. I mean, I guess for this, I'm actually about observations. Right. So yeah, you could have you could indeed produce that. I mean, in fact, I mean, if you say, well, an individual wouldn't form, if you want to make a whole solar system, well, and you replace this, I think, I don't know, was it maybe 10 to the 99 or something?
You see, the bio observers get reincarnated in the future by similar fluctuations.
Right. So it's just the thing is, see, if you imagine they form by fluctuation, then you could have a whole solar system formed, and then you know, maybe the observations, as long as they didn't look out beyond the solar system, would be virtually identical to ours.
You have a galaxy formed.
Yeah, so you could have a galaxy, but the probability of those is much less.
So that's why I wondered. Is that, it's partly related to what Tony asked? Does that undermine or modify this argument in any way? I mean, eventually,
well,
there'll be zillions of those too, albeit over a much longer time scale.
Yeah, the zillion of those. But then it's the point. I mean, you know, if you suppose that the probability really is non-zero and the universe goes on forever, so that they really dominate, then you could ask, well, is it consistent with our observations? We could say, well, maybe we should believe we are Boltzmann brains. But I think the problem with that is it's much more probable to form a Boltzmann brain of the smallest possible thing, like just the human brain. Say, or some people propose maybe even simpler things could make observations. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm making an observation, so therefore I think at least it's a sufficient condition to produce a human brain. So if you can produce a human brain by vacuum fluctuation as opposed to thermal fluctuation, then there's at least this probability of producing a human brain. But I think the probability would be much lower if you wanted to produce a human brain that had coherent observations, or I mean, you require much more order to it. So therefore, if we are Boltzmann brains, it would be extremely surprising that our observations would be as ordered as ours are. So I think that's the evidence that we aren't Boltzmann brains. Yes?
If I can summarize this in some neutral way, right, which is you've shown, right, that if we assume we're typical of this big class of objects,
right,
that then known physics doesn't work and we have to modify it in some way, right, in order to get out of this. I would much prefer to assume we're not typical and keep the known physics.
Yeah, okay, I suppose I could summarize. Now, you're being a little bit even too generous to be in this, because, of course, I've made a bunch of assumptions here, like regularizing by co-moving volume, and there are other ways. I mean, Lindy and Vilenkin and others, they have various ways of regularizing that can also get rid of Boltzmann brains. I'm just not extremely happy with their methods. So there are other ways to solve the problem, which you can keep typicality, which I think Lindy and Vilenkin and others would prefer to keep it. But you could, but it's true. I guess you could go your route, but you and I are having discussions as to how, you know, whether that's a good route to take.
Just quote Chairman Mao. Right? Let 100 flowers bloom and 100 competing schools of thought contend.
Right, right. Yeah, so that's, no, I mean, right. I agree. That's why it's fun to be here. We can have these discussions. I appreciate the
but the students in the other 99 schools do not get jobs.
Right.
Okay, Andy's been waiting to.
So of course, this is only a problem if you accept the anthropic principle and want to use it to explain something, of course. Right. Mm-hmm. And so are you saying that there I haven't followed this very carefully, but you're saying that there are people who have various proposals to use the anthropic principle to explain something, and their proposals are internally inconsistent because it predicts too many Boltzmann brains, is that?
Well, I'm saying that at least there's some ways of regularizing, which the anthropic principle by itself doesn't solve all problems. I mean,
it may not solve any problems, right?
Yeah, if you find that most observers, I guess I would say assuming typicality, I mean, Jim and I differ about that, so we're different flowers in that, or different flower children or whatever in that regard. So therefore, if I say I'm in the typicality crowd, I think like maybe Lindy and Vilenkin of assuming they were typical in some sense.
I'm wondering does this pertain to some specific proposal that somebody has about a measure or some way of explaining?
Well, it's motivating a proposal I'm making for a measure. So that's this was supposed to be sort of motivation, and then I'm coming up with sort of a proposal for possibly solving the measure problem, which is one of many. I mean, there are probably hundreds of flowers about the measure problem that have already sprouted, and I'm sort of trying to sprout my own. Yes?
So just to sort of give a reply to Jim, I mean, you know, Copernicus has worked for us pretty well so far. And so while we could throw him out, if there's a way to save him, which I think is what Don is proposing to do, we might at least want to look at it before just saying, well, yeah, if we throw Copernicus out, the whole problem disappears, which is true. But it's not necessarily the only solution we'd want to entertain.
Yeah,
right, right.
I'll just quote Chairman Mao.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, they should have
did after he said.
Right.
Chairman Mao did after he said.
Yeah. Yeah. He lapped off all the other, you know. So we don't want to do that. we'll just take the quote literally as opposed to, you know, the way it actually worked out in history.
Okay.
Copernicus principle, isn't your worry analogous to worrying about why, say, Earth is in this position in the universe as opposed to virtually infinitely many other positions?
Well, it's more, I mean, it's maybe not the Copernicus, I mean, I don't know what it's Copernican. I'm just basically, I suppose my assumption is that in some sense, I'm a typical observer, or in some sense, I want to be able to calculate probabilities for observations, and I don't, and they're going to come out as likely, they're going to be interpreted, I'm going to interpret as likelihoods for theories, but maybe I should get to that before. So this was largely motivation. Okay, so now let's get into my assumption for what goal of science. So, okay, so goal of science, notice I say a goal, there may be hundreds of other goals, but a goal is that we would like a complete theory, and let's say, I mean, maybe in the end we want one, but first we're going to look for competing ones and test them, compare them. So theory T sub I, predicting probabilities, PJ of I, that's the probability of an observation, O sub J is an observation, given the theory T sub I. So this is would often be interpreted as this would often be interpreted as the likelihood of the theory. It's the probability that you get the observation given the theory. Okay, then now I'm just proposing some principles for these that I think are reasonable, but you know they may not. I think Jim has perhaps disagreed with with some of these, but these are my formulation. Is that first of all, prior alternatives principle, the set of alternatives to be assigned probabilities by the theory should be chosen independent of the observation O sub J to be used to test the theories. In other words, the theory should tell you what the set of possible observations are, and you shouldn't just go out and make an observation and I see sunlight there and I'm going to now make my theory predict the probability of either that or of not that, say. The possible observation should be chosen independent of it.
These are our observations or the observations of ants on the planet Sargon or something like that as well?
Yeah, they could be observations. They could be observations of whatever you consider to be observing. I mean, people might differ about that. I mean, I personally tend to think it should be conscious observations, but you could, you know, you could differ. You could make it observations of a complete human scientific IGUS or well, I would allow anything except, I mean, for me personally, I would prefer to stick to conscious observations. I would not, if it's true, I don't fully know, but I suspect a rock doesn't have much measure of consciousness. But if you know, you might say, well, we'll include all tracks of particles going through rocks or something. I guess I would not take that route, but I mean, if you could, I suppose, if you wanted to, I would want to, you know, assume it is really observed when there's a conscious being aware of it. But all, yeah. So whatever the, I mean, of course, we don't know what. I mean, I do assume that other higher mammals are conscious and they do make observations, but we don't know for sure. I mean, we'd like to have a theory that tells this. Okay, then the next thing is this too, the principle of observational discrimination. Each possible complete observation should uniquely distinguish one element from the set of alternatives. So that is the idea, is that you want the observer itself to be able to distinguish. You don't have to rely on some super observer that looks about what all observers are doing. You want to be able to have something, you know, I see red or I see blue or, you know, I see the Hubble constant being such and such or whatever, but you don't want to have to appeal to some super observer that we don't have access to.
In that case, the OJ just refer to human beings or something.
So the OJ, well, you would have to choose it. I mean, I personally would say the OJ are, all the OJs are conscious perceptions, what a conscious being is aware of. Now, that's one choice. You could make another choice if you want to. You could say it's...
Is it okay to make the choice just human beings? Because otherwise, I don't see how you know what the OJ are.
Well, I don't. I mean, I think I would want it to be everything that I consider to be conscious observation. So, if dogs are conscious, I would want to just arbitrarily exclude them. But I would exclude, if rocks aren't conscious, I would exclude rocks. But the reason I exclude rocks is that they aren't conscious.
They're conscious beings, I mean, on other planets. Are they included or not?
Yeah, they would be included too. Right, right.
And how do we ever figure out what the OJ are?
Well, this should be...
To get a complete set of them.
Yeah, I mean, this is something, of course, we don't have yet. I mean, this would be a goal of the theory. So this is a goal. So a goal is to have a theory that gives you a set of... probably a very, very big set, because even human observations, it's a huge number of possible, you know, conscious awarenesses that each human can have. So it's a big set, and then if you, you know, and then if you include other things, I mean, it may be beyond us to actually imagine it. I mean, like, well, Nagel has said something about what is it like to be a bat? I mean, it's very hard to even imagine what the consciousness of a bat is. But so I'm sort of imagining some super theory or some future theory that, you know, has all these possible observations in them and can calculate them. So then the idea is, of, okay, if we make observation, that should distinguish, I mean, that should be some element in this set that's predicted by the theory. Yeah, it might be, right, right, very, very tiny element, but we should distinguish it. And then, of course, and then I do, since on a normalization principle, for each theory, for each I, if we sum over the observations, the sum of the probabilities of all that should add up to one. So it's all, so I'm normalizing the probability of observations to be that. So that's what I'm sort of a...
So you realize that, sorry, this kind of talk, of course, invites questions.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
What does the word complete mean? Complete observation? How do I know, if I'm an experimentalist, how do I know my observation is complete?
Well, how is it? I mean, this would be, okay... This is in some sense for that. Now, I'm used to thinking about this in terms of conscious awareness. So by that, I would mean everything you're presently aware of, everything you're consciously aware of right now. So it could be your visual image of me. It could be what you're hearing me say. It could be, you know, if you're aware of whether you're hungry or not hungry or what.
As experimental techniques improve, you realize the observation you made yesterday was incomplete, right?
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, but in this sense, of course, it, for conscious beings, you have a new observation each day or each moment. I mean, each moment you have a different observation. So the observation, it's complete at the moment. I mean, I don't mean that you know everything about the universe. It's just you know everything about what you're conscious of. Yes, Rob.
Well, I mean, I've asked you about this before, but I can't resist again. And part of the problem I see is that different conscious beings will, I don't see how they can agree on what it is they perceive. Take the example of people that are colorblind relative to those that are not. So I'll say, I see blue, I see red. Well, a colorblind person says, no, that's an irrelevant observation because I'm incapable of consciously perceiving it. And I know we're going to do a song and dance about light at frequencies and so on, but my perception of color is certainly outside of the conceptual framework of a conscious being that is incapable of perceiving color. So what I think is needed then, you need a meta-theory to decide what counts for OJ and TI, which is partly what Jim is saying. I mean, I appreciate the ideal, but if you have different observers that literally have mutually exclusive possibilities of perception, it's not clear this is possible.
But all of them are in there. I mean, so in other words, the one person that can see color, like I can be aware that you're wearing, I think it's green, and Mark's wearing blue, so I can be aware that that's a tiny part of my present conscious perception.
Colorblind people have to trust those that are not.
Colorblind people make their own observations, which don't include the perception of the different colors. So they have their own, I mean, you know.
Why should they count color perception as observation then? That's what I don't understand.
But it's whatever they're aware of. And if they're not aware of color, that's not part of their. I mean, in other words.
Is that OJ specific to a particular observer? That is,
the OJ is a set of all possible conscious awareness for all possible observers. So it's a huge set. So for
it's summing to one. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, if you're looking at all possible positions, you would expect the probabilities when you sum over all possible positions to be one. But not if you sum over all possible positions and all possible momentum and all possible energies and all possible everything else you can think of. That doesn't sum to one.
No, but what I want to say, okay, I've made an observation. I want to calculate the probability of that observation according to the theory. And if I want to calculate the probability of that, I have to think that there's alternative observations. And if this is one of a number of alternatives, then the sum of those probabilities for all the alternatives should add up to one. So that's the assumption that I'm observing one possibility out of a huge set of alternatives. And I want to calculate the probability of that the theory assigned. The theory should tell me the probability of, if it's a complete theory, it should tell me the probability of that observation.
But you're not summing over all possible observations.
I'm not summing it, but the theory should tell, the theory should give probabilities that do sum to one. I'm saying it's sort of nonsense if the theory gives probabilities that don't sum to one. It's kind of a nonsensical, it doesn't make sense to call them probabilities if they don't sum to one.
But then you have to build in, you know, the notion that things are not only complete, but also mutually exclusive.
Exactly. Right. And that's the point. Because I'm talking about the observation of a particular conscious being, my observation of you is mutually exclusive for what you're observing right now. Those are two mutually exclusive observations. Because, I mean, my perception is just not the same as yours. So it's two different possibilities. So I'm not trying to say, because the thing is, I'm trying to avoid a super observer that sees everything. I'm trying to get it down to what we observe. So if we get it down to what we observe, then of course there would be many actual observations. I mean, there's mine right now, there's each of yours right now, and I also believe that I had observations in the past, and I believe you had observations in the past. So, you know, and then now we can consider off to more people. There's other people elsewhere in the world that have had observations now and observations in the past of the future, and there may be other beings on other planets. Well, there's dogs here on Earth, and there's other beings on other planets. There's a huge number of these things, but what I want to do is get a theory that allows me to calculate likelihood from just knowing one of these observations. I don't have to be a super observer that can see everything that's going on. All I have to do is to be able to see what I see.
But why are they exclusive? I mean, why are your observations exclusive?
Well, they're exclusive because they're different. I mean, my observation is different from yours. It's just a different. Well, it's exclusive since they're not the same. I mean, in other words, if I imagine all possible things I could be aware of, then each thing, if it's distinguishable, each thing that's distinguishable, then I will say it's different. And if they're different, they're exclusive.
Let me put it this way. Why don't you put an index K on the O, where index K indicates which observer it is that's doing it?
Well, I don't want to do that because for me, the conscious perceptions themselves are more unique. I don't think observers, I mean, maybe this gets into the more heretical parts of my belief that I don't even believe persons are, I believe in a quantum state of the universe, but I don't believe that particles are fundamental, maybe strings or something else, but particles aren't, and I don't believe chairs are fundamental, I don't even believe persons are fundamental, but I believe conscious perceptions are fundamental. Now, I agree there's a very good approximate concept that there's sort of like a sequence of observations that I could say are mine, but if I go off into the ever many worlds, I could probably trace back the sequence of my observations, and probably by going backward and forward and crossing the ever many worlds, I could probably go from a sequence of my perceptions and go to Joe's perception. So, therefore, I don't see any uniqueness, any unique identification of the observers. So, I really want to, that's why I want to just focus on the observations, not the observer. But I'm just imagining each different observation is distinct, and therefore, in that sense, it's mutually exclusive. If it is one observation, that's distinct from a different one, and therefore, I'm calling them mutually exclusive.
We're talking about particles and their positions. 100 particles, we would label the particles from 1 to 100. Each one would have a position, right? It would have a little spectrum of position you could talk about.
Yeah, but the particles may not be distinguishable. So it's sort of like the...
But suppose the particles were distinguishable.
Okay, but I want a theory that applies that even if they aren't, because that's the point. The universe might be so large that there might be something like an exact copy of me way off over somewhere else. And I don't want to, and the point is, maybe a super observer could tell the difference because of the surroundings. You could say, well, Don A is here, you know, in this galaxy, in this room, but maybe there's Don B, and maybe he's in the, maybe if he has the same perception, he's got the same immediate surroundings. He's surrounded by a KITP that's identical. But if you go beyond the particle horizon, Don B has a different, you know, the surroundings that are outside the particle horizon for Don B are different from Don A, but that's only seen by the super observer, and I don't want to have to invoke a super observer.
That's interesting, but you're distinguishable from me, so why don't we write down the probability of Don's observations, J, 1 through J, and Jim's observations, 1 through J.
Well, you could do that, but I think I'd prefer to just say it, if I considered the observations, I mean, I myself am aware that I'm Don Page, and I assume you're not presently aware that you're Don Page. So that's a distinction, and it's already in the observation. So I don't need an extra index to characterize it, because it's already within, in this approximate sense that we do have sort of an identity, then my observation itself includes, well, at least if I think about who I am, I mean, maybe there's times I don't think who I am, but at least if I'm aware of who I am, then that it's already included in the content.
So J somehow...
So it's really a tensor product. You're looking at a given time at the all possible states of mind of all possible observers.
Not at a given time. I'm not restricting given time. Oh, no. I don't believe in time. I mean, that's another thing I don't believe is fundamental.
Okay. So
I mean, there's a quantum state of the universe, and time may be an approximate constant, but I don't want to restrict to some...
But it's still a tensor product. You're looking...
Tensor product over what?
Over all observers and all their possible states of mind over all times. So it's the entire history of all the states.
So it's all of them. I'm not too sure what the tensor problem. I mean, it's a set of all possible observations. It's a set of all possible observations. I don't know what's tensor or what's product about it, but there's a set of all possible observations.
Tensor product over all observers, so that you don't need another index, right? I mean, there's some big space of all the possible states of mind of all the possible observers over.
Okay.
And that's what OJ means. A given OJ is a given history of all the states of mind of all the observers.
No, it's not a history because it doesn't include the OJ. Just includes your present perception. Of course, your present perception could have memory elements in it, so include your memory, but it won't include.
Okay.
In other words, if a Boltzmann brain formed, it would be extremely unlikely that the Boltzmann brain would form with your present perception. But it could. I mean, there'd be some extremely tiny fraction of Boltzmann brains that could form with exactly your present perception. And that would count. I mean, that would, if it's exactly the present perception, it'd be exactly the same OJ. So there could be a contribution to the probability. The theory might give a contribution to this probability from a Boltzmann brain, in which there was no, it just formed immediately. It formed at a very short time, so it doesn't have a big history. So I don't have histories in here. There's no histories. I mean, at least as far as the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing are the observations. The theory may describe this. A classical theory might say that you got there by some classical history. Maybe quantum theory says that you get there by some path integral. So there might be histories in the path integral, but not in this. This is just the observation. It doesn't have anything. It may have, of course, memory of history, memory that we interpret as history, but it doesn't by itself include history.
But it's an observation made by a single individual or the collective set of observations?
By a single individual, at least to the extent that, you know, I assume that my observation is in some sense directly produced by my brain, and so that's sort of a single individual. Now, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, you contribute to my observation in the sense that you're producing input. You're producing physical input that goes through my eyes and ears and goes into my brain. But I think what I'm conscious of, I'm just assuming practically, probably just depends on what's in there. You know, now it could be, maybe I have two parts of my brain that's separate. I don't know. Maybe, you know, you could have multiple personality disorder and have maybe, I don't know if those people really do have two different parts of their brains that are sort of, you know, there could be more than one consciousness for a single brain. I don't know about that, but I mean, I'm sort of imagining that what I'm conscious of really depends on what's inside my brain, and it depends on you only to the extent that you provide data that eventually gets into my brain.
But why do you exclude, I mean, you know, collections of people like David was saying?
Well, I'd say I guess if the collection does have a separate consciousness, I could do that. It's just,
what does it mean, consciousness?
Well, being aware, being directly aware. I mean, it's like it's sort of a first person experience of being aware. Like if you're aware of seeing me and aware of hearing me, then that's
the two of us are aware.
Well, I'm aware. I'm aware of seeing you, hearing you. Pardon?
Not me.
I'm aware of you, and I assume you're aware of me, but I haven't seen any evidence. I mean, I don't wish to exclude the possibility, but I don't see any evidence that there's some extra awareness that comes from the collectivity.
Is the society aware of the current economic crisis or not?
Yeah. That's the part. I'm not using that awareness in that metaphorical sense. I would mean that the content would have to be in the individual observers. That may be some metaphorical way of saying that, well, individual people are aware that times are tough, but it's only the individuals. Now, as I say, I'm not excluding the possibility but I think it's very remote, that the whole collectivity has some consciousness that's not possessed by each individual. But I haven't seen any evidence for that, so it's very hard for me to think about that possibility.
The collection that's inside your head, all those nerve cells.
Yeah, well, that I think, I mean, that I'm directly aware of something, so I know that's producing something. But I have no evidence that the collection of all people or society, that there has any awareness other than what's going on in each individual's brain. So I'm talking about consciousness in the sense that each person can have it. And, of course, what I'm consciously aware of depends on input from other people. But I'm making sort of like working hypothesis that it's just because it entered my brain and I became conscious of it. And if it didn't enter my brain, there wouldn't be any. So I'm not saying the internet, for example. I don't see any evidence that the internet by per se has consciousness. Of course, the internet affects the input that goes into each of our brains. So what I'm aware of, I'm aware of the internet. So of course, my consciousness depends on the internet, but I don't believe that there's some consciousness as a whole associated with the internet. Whereas I do, I just know from personal experience that it's associated with my brain, and I assume because you act and behave and look fairly similar that presumably, you know, the same thing's going on in each of your brains.
Some people claim a thermostat is conscious, right? It's got a sort of limited consciousness. It's too hot in here, it's too hot in here. It's too cold in here, it's too cold in here. Would you say a thermostat should be included in this?
Well, I'm talking about the first person experience of consciousness. So I'm not going to say that I know a thermostat's not conscious, but by conscious, I mean the first person phenomenological experience, not the behavior. So it's not a behaviorist term. So if you say a thermostat behaves as if it's conscious, that doesn't count as conscious for me. So if you, for example, you know, if a person really were a zombie and walked around being totally unconscious, but did exactly the same things as we do, I wouldn't count that as conscious either, although might be hard.
Physical measurement?
Maybe we can even go
on. Yeah. So, okay, well, let me get to Barnes.
At one point about the economic crisis, it appears that the Republicans are unaware of it. Does that mean they're not conscious?
Well, okay, but you could also, of course, I might want to distinguish between what one's conscious of and what one publicly admits that one's conscious of. So that, okay, so traditional quantum theory, Born rule, will say that the probabilities of things are given by the expectation values of projection operators. Well, this is about, I mean, Born didn't have this in his very short Nobel Prize winning paper, and he didn't have the projection operators, but let's suppose we take that. So if it was a pure state with a pure state, then it would be this. Of course, it could be a mixed state, or it could be a C-star algebra. And then the projection operators, for distinct observations, then the projection operators are supposed to, well, be zero. The product is supposed to be zero. If they're the same, the product just gives itself again. Okay, now let's suppose that space-time has a large number of regions, and they're labeled from 1 to k, but it's only the super-observer that knows the k. So the observations within the region don't determine what it is. So now let's suppose that within a particular region, within the same K, we do have at least some approximation. The projection operators obey that. But on the other hand, if you go to different regions, then they don't necessarily give zero. In other words, you could have a Don A here and making an observation, and a Don A way, way out over there making a different observation, and it's not zero for the probability for the same observation to be mean here and way over there. So now you're trying to get to the probability of this observation. And you can't really just say, I mean, one thing, you might say, well, we'll just choose a region and then we'll say it's the expectation by that. But the trouble is we don't know what the K is. Unless we're a super observer, we don't know where we are in this grand thing. So now another thing you could try, and this is essentially what Jim and Mark try, I mean, is to say, let's suppose we'll make a projection operator, and let's suppose that the different ones commuted for simplicity. Then we can say, well, we'll ask for a projection operator that this observation will occur at least somewhere. So the identity minus that is the probability it doesn't occur in that region. So the product of that's the probability, the expectation value of that is the probability it occurs nowhere. And so the expectation value of I minus that is the probability it occur at least somewhere. So you could choose that, but the trouble is that gives things that aren't normalized. Because, of course, even if I had two observers, suppose I had Don A has 50% chance of seeing red, 50% blue, Don B has 50% chance, 50% being blue, and assume they're independent, then there's a 3/4 chance that at least one of us will see red, and there's a 3/4 chance that at least one of us will see blue. So those don't add up to one. So to get normalizable ones, when we can't use these projection operators, or we can't directly write it as the expectation value of projection operators. So it seems like traditional quantum formulation or Born's rule doesn't work when there may be copies of an observation or observer or observation situation. There's more copies of the thing, so the Born rule dies. So to give an example of, now I don't have a unique prescription what's replacing it. It was the motivation to choose some volume averaging rather than volume weighting, but let me just show an example of different rules. Suppose, just for simplicity, we'll take a quantum state that has exactly two components, and suppose each component has n sub I brain size regions, where I'm imagining discreting. It's a toy model. I mean, it's obviously this is very, very, very truncated. And suppose there's three possibilities of what happens in each region. Either it's empty, or there's an ordinary observer there, or there's a Boltzmann brain there. And for simplicity, I'm assuming there's really only two kind of possible observations. So it's very, very truncated toy model. Two possible observations that are distinguishable. Ordinary observer, maybe order, and maybe disorder in that one. And now we want the probabilities for these two possible observations, either observe an ordinary observation or a Boltzmann brain observation, and we want them normalized. So let's just to put some numbers to show how extreme some of these numbers could be. Let's say, well, in the present observable universe, if you take the volume of the human brain, the present observable universe is about 10 to the 85 times that. And there is, or maybe 7 billion, let's say 10 to the 10th human brains today. And for this part, I'm not going to ignore dogs for the moment, but anyway, this is just putting in numbers. And then Boltzmann brains will be, well, that might be a number, but I'm going to make a discrete number. So let's just say 0 Boltzmann brains today. Okay, now let's suppose that the quantum state is a superposition of that, and another one at some, when the universe is expanded by some huge amount. So anyway, I pulled out some thing from some paper by Lindin, Vilenkin, and a bunch of other people of decay rates in the universe, and one had suggested maybe the universe is decaying at a rate of the inverse of this. So let's suppose the universe is so big that it's got this many regions, and ordinary observers have died out, and Boltzmann brains, it's this volume, but then times e to the minus 10 to the 42 for the number of Boltzmann. So the number of Boltzmann brains is enormously less than that, but still, because this exponent is much bigger than that, there's still an enormous number of Boltzmann brains. And for simplicity, let's suppose that we have equal amplitude for these two things, so the probability of being this or this is a half. Well, so this is just three possible rules you could put down. One of them is just that you weight the square of the amplitudes by the number of observers of the right type. So for an ordinary observer, you say, and you take the square of the for O1 ordinary observers, and then add on to that, and then divide by the sum over all possible observers. So if you did that, then with these numbers, then it's dominated the that's zero. The numerators, and then there's the halves, which cancel out. So it's basically this over the biggest thing in the denominator is B2. So according to this rule, the probability of an ordinary observation would be e to the minus 10 to the 56, because there's far more Boltzmann brains than humans. Now, rule two might be that we, instead of just summing up over them, we'll divide by the number of regions. So we're taking an average number of observers of a given type per volume. And so if you do that, you could divide by the total number of regions in each case. And that's in this case because dividing by the number of regions make these last parts very tiny, and so it's essentially just this, well, and there's no Boltzmann brains out. So this is just one with a tiny correction from this factor, so it's extremely close to one in this case. So here it was extremely close to zero, here it's extremely close to one. Rule three might be, well, you just say, okay, we have probability to be component one, and then we ask what fraction of observers are ordinary observers, and this fraction was one in the early time, in the later time the fraction was zero, so we just get half in this case. So rule one is analogous to volume weighting, which has been traditionally, I think, is what's been done in inflationary theory. And what I'm going to propose is something like rule two, analogous to volume averaging, dividing by the volume. And rule three would be analogous to what you assume if you didn't take ever many worlds, if you collapse the wave function. You say, well, you either collapse it onto one or the other, and then calculate what your things are. I did write several years ago the fact that this is, well, I didn't think of this possibility years ago. I thought it was either this or this, and I thought this is what Everett gives, and this is what collapse version gives. So this is a way, in principle, to distinguish between collapse versions of quantum mechanics and the Everett version, if the quantum state were suitable. So at least, you know, now, of course, you could say, because I'm saying born rule dead, I could imagine using this rule even if the wave function didn't collapse. So I'm not absolutely sure if you found the probability, the theories were consistent with this rule, I'm not sure that would prove the wave function collapsed. But on the other hand, if you found it was consistent with one of these and not consistent with that, I think that would be good evidence against the idea that the wave function collapses. Okay, so let's see, I'll probably have to skip fast. Well, okay, this measure problem, past approaches, they've usually focused on some classical space-times, regularizing it by cutoffs at, say, fixed time, or some initial time, or maybe fixed scale factor. But if the universe is quantum, it seems like these classical space-time histories are not fundamental, so it seems not the best thing to be to try to impose on these classical histories. So it seemed, I'd prefer something based more on more localized quantities that can be represented by quantum operators. Instead of not having histories, but having, not having classical histories at least, but having more local operators, such as in quantum conical quantum gravity, the 3 geometry rather than the 4 geometry. Now, I know I'm not saying that we should stick with that. I know there's problems with canonical quantum gravity, but I'm just saying I'm even less happy doing things involving 4 geometry than 3 geometry. So then the idea is, okay, just using as a sort of a motivation, not saying this is the final quantum theory of gravity, if you did canonical quantum cosmology, you have the wave function, it's a functional of 3 geometries, and this symbolizes the 3-dimensional matter field configurations on there. So operators could be written in terms of 3 geometries and spatial field configurations. So then I might imagine the projection operator to have this observation in some region might be represented by some field configuration at some location and some orientation, including the boost at some location. So now I'm suggesting if we can't use the expectation by projection operators, we still might imagine that the probabilities of observations are given by expectation values of some operators. So it could be, and to normalize it, let's suppose that we have some other unnormalized operator, and then we will just divide by the sum over all possible observations, the sum of the expectation value of all possible observations, in order to get an operator that's normalized. So you could imagine that then this, you could imagine, could be a projection operator to some field configuration at some location and orientation, and then integrated over all possible locations and orientations of the things. So this integral would include a volume integral over locations, but how do you do it? If you volume weighted, you would just basically have this, if you had a compact three geometry, it would just be proportional to the volume. But I'm suggesting maybe not do it that way. Maybe do it so that this weighting factor gives something independent of the three volume. So volume weighting would give more weighting to these operators for greater volumes, whereas if you did the volume averaging, you divide by the volume of the three geometry, then you wouldn't get that thing. So the Boltzmann-Brain catastrophe seems to be worse. Now, indeed, I should say Lindy and Vilenkin and Busso and others do have other ways of solving the Boltzmann-Brain catastrophe, usually involving some cutoffs with the classical space-time. That's why I'm not terribly happy with them. So I'm not saying this is the only way to solve the problem. I'm just trying to suggest a way that might fit better with a more quantum approach to the thing. So then, okay, we might say, all right, even though ultimately it should be done quantum, how do you do it if you had a classical space-time? Well, then we could say, okay, this is some integral over all three geometries, and of course, even if you had approximately classical space-time, you'd have an integral over all spatial hypersurfaces. And this, I don't know how to do. So this is a difficult part. This is getting the part that, you know, I don't have a good solution for it. So I might suppose that, well, maybe I'll just gauge fix to some particular hypersurfaces. So you can gauge fix to that. Well, one proposal is to use the old idea that's been common in general relativity, which is to use surfaces of constant extrinsic curvature. Or I might say constant H, constant one-third the trace of the extrinsic curvature, or one-third the logarithmic volume expansion rate. So you could, if I chose those, then I could choose volume average proper time to be the 4 volume between 2 slices divided by the 3 volume of one of the nearby slices. So that would be a volume average proper time. And then you could do this volume average. You divide by the volume and then do this integral at fixed t. You still have a choice of, if you have this sequence of hypersurfaces, how do you do that? So there's different ways you could. Probably the simplest is what I would focus on. Just let that have a proportional to time. If you did this, you'd be back to volume averaging, volume weighting, and let's ignore that one for the moment because I don't have time for that. Let's see. There was an alternate gauge fixing minimal flux hypersurface. I think I'll skip that. Okay, so consequences, well, let's see, let's probably... Volume average seems to be a good solution if you still have to have the lifetime of the universe not terribly long. Because if it's really, really long, then even if you're not counting bigger volumes as the universe expands, you still have the universe last too long. So you would require, but that seems to be easier in string theory to have that sort of thing. Let's ignore this one. anyway, okay, there's just some idea that it proportional to the proper time.
All these different possibilities for weighting.
Right.
Do these involve modifying the rules of quantum mechanics, or are these somehow choices within?
It's just the choices of how do you get probabilities from the quantum state. So that this is all not modifying the quantum state. I mean, you have to have some rule for the dynamics, which, I mean, traditionally people call the theory of everything, although that's kind of a misnomer because you also have to know what the quantum state is. I mean, that's what Jim Harlan and Stephen Hawking have made a proposal for the quantum state. So you have to know both that. But what I'm saying is this is a third thing you need. You not only need to know the evolution, but you need to get the rule for how to get the probabilities of observations from the quantum state.
But if I go back to your projection operators, so you had your P sub k's or P superscript k's, where
right.
K indicated somehow indexed different regions.
Right.
Are your proposals equivalent to taking, to weighting the P sub k's with some probability weight factor, W sub k, which just...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's equivalent.
And are the W sub k's independent of the quantum state?
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's right. It would be that. And then so now I'm just suggesting is that traditionally people have done it. So you just weight by something that's essentially proportional to the 4-volume. Basically means when you have a bigger 3-volume, you count it more. But what I'm proposing is if the volume expands, you divide by the volume. So that in some sense you're just looking at. You're effectively looking at the density per volume of observers rather than the total number of observers. So you don't get an enhancement factor when the universe is when it's expanded enormously larger. You don't get a big enhancement factor just because there's more volume and therefore more observers.
But taking a step back,
right?
If I picked some distribution W sub k on the regions or identical copies or whatever,
right?
We could ask various questions about it. We could ask if we like it
right.
for this or that reason. We could ask if it's...
Yeah, that's this word. Okay.
So it seems to me that any choice that's normalized or whatever is consistent. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think anything is consistent. So it's a question, then it's a question of the trade-off that you'd like to get higher, as high a likelihood as possible. In other words, you want to make your observations as probable as possible, although we know, of course, because there's a huge range of possible observations, the probability of any individual one is going to be quite low. But we like that. But we also want high prior probabilities, and I think most of us would think that simpler theories have higher prior probabilities. So if the complete theory includes not only the dynamics and the quantum state, but also this weighting factor, we would presumably prefer to have a simpler weighting factor. And it's a question of what. So that's. Yeah, I think it's a part of the theory that's not determined. I mean, it's maybe somewhat analogous to the fact that even if you know the dynamics, you don't know what the quantum state is. But it's still, I'm saying that that's really something that a complete theory should have. It should tell you this.
Well, what if it does? I would claim the theories are never going to tell you this, and you always have to pick it.
Yeah, but somebody could also claim the theory will always give the dynamics and will never give the initial conditions. But that didn't stop Jim and Stephen from making a proposal. And I think that proposal is quite scientific. It may be wrong, but it's a very scientific proposal. I regard it as a tremendous advance to propose including that within a scientific theory, including what the quantum state of the universe is. So, I mean, that's a... extremely important thing that I think Jim did. We haggle now a bit about whether the particular proposal fits observations, but I think it was an extremely important conceptual advance. So I'm proposing now that you not only need that, you also need to have to put in your theory the rule from going from quantum theory to the probabilities. So, okay, well, I think I'm running out of time, and this is some problem I have particularly with the Hartle-Hawking state, but okay, well, let's see, maybe let's skip the eternal inflation. Not all that many eternal inflation here. There was the one I wanted to ask the string theorists. I think I did ask some of you this, but this is the one for Joe, maybe. That you consider the problem of producing conscious brains. Could I interpret the holographic principle to say that the state of any bulk object is dual to some state on a surrounding finite surface? I think Gary was telling me maybe no, but anyway, I'll get your opinion too later, and yours, Veronica. So if that were true, could you translate it to the problem of the quantum state on a two surface of say a few square meters? And then the question is, if you do the global state and string theory, could you actually calculate that density matrix? And then, of course, some little slightly detailed questions is that, are there discrete values for the area? And for each discrete value, is there roughly this many states in the area? Or do you have to have a discretum of different areas to get this number of states or what? But anyway, this is just my ignorance of string theory and hope that when I'm here to get some advice on it. Okay, well, my hour is up, so let me just conclude that as far as this widespread assumption, which I shared, of volume weighting, I did use it to try to defend the Hartle-Hawking proposal years ago against Flinkens. It seems to lead to eternal inflation, at least to non-zero probabilities of having the universe infinitely big. But it also has its grave dangers. Not necessarily proof that Boltzmann-Brain catastrophe would happen, because there are other right ways of regularizing it, or at least serious ambiguities in the measure problem. So volume averaging instead of volume weighting seems to give a less ambiguous measures and possible a solution to the Boltzmann-Brain catastrophe, at least if you have a suitable quantum state, which I didn't have time to get into too much. So consequence of volume average seems to be the internal inflation would not occur, at least in the sense of giving a positive probability for infinite volume. So the probability of a closed universe is arbitrarily large would be infinitesimal, although the expectation value of the volume might still diverge. Well, there's many loose ends with this. I don't really know how to, really do the integration over the hypersurfaces or do the gauge fixing or that sort of thing. But at least the volume averaging seems to be something that I'd put forward at Mary Morgan's study, as well as this other logically independent idea that we need more than just the quantum state and Born's rule. We need something new to give us probabilities for observations out from quantum theory. So with that, I'll stop.
Urgent questions?
I'm still a bit confused by what Mark said, but it does seem that volume averaging is something you have to inject into the theory in addition. So are you anticipating there'll be some broader theory that will tell you what kind of volume averaging to do?
Yeah, well, ultimately I would hope that there's some that in the quantum theory, in the structure of the quantum theory itself, say string theory or whatever, that something will emerge from that looks rather natural. Since I don't know that, I'm sort of trying to describe it in somewhat classical terms. And therefore, I'm just saying if I do some sort of classical approximation, that I'm saying maybe it will turn out to be something like this volume averaging.
But at this stage, you have to tell the formalism how to volume average. The formalism doesn't tell you.
Yeah, the formalism, and I don't think...
Right.
That's right, right. It doesn't tell you, and I wouldn't expect the theory of the dynamics by itself to do that. But of course, once we have the theory of dynamics, it might be simpler to see what a proposal is. I mean, it's just like, path integral formulation of quantum gravity doesn't tell you what the quantum state is, but once you have that language, it motivates, or at least it gives, you can look for something like the Hartle-Hawking wave function. That it's within the formalism of path integral for quantum gravity, it's sort of maybe natural to consider that sort of state. And so what I'm hoping is that maybe once we have the full quantum theory, it may suggest something, but I don't think it's going to logically imply it. I think this is logically independent of what the quantum state is. Yes?
So what was it you were going to say about eternal inflation?
Well, okay, I'll let's see, where how far back am I? Well, it's it, this assumption of volume waves, it seems like it's been an argument for at least some of the conclusions. Now, I mean, some people say if you interpret it, that internal inflation is just a fact of dynamics. But so anyway, the idea that fluctuations, you have this scalar field that's rolling down, and the idea is that all this more probably roll down. If it rolls up, the volume grows. And then if you weight that by the volume, of course, you get it dominated by the thing fluctuating up. So it seems like that you... But without the volume weighting, then the slow roll without the significant upward fluctuations would dominate. So if the inflaton's a massive scalar field, and this mass, I think, is more or less right to give the right delta rho over rho we see, then the universe would expand by some factor like this, which is very large, but it's not infinite. And so I'm not aware of any observational distinctions between inflation to this size and eternal inflation, other than the Boltzmann brain catastrophe. If it indeed, you know, if this produces a Boltzmann brain catastrophe, then that would be maybe rule that out. But it could be that the volume weighting is wrong, and this is probably stated a little bit too strong. There's no eternal inflation in the sense of having a positive probability of a universe of infinite size. Under this, the probability distribution would tail off as you go to infinity. It could well be that if you take the expectation value of the volume, that might be infinite. But at least the probability, it's unit probability that it's, well, almost unit probability that it's smaller than some utterly huge size. Okay, thank you. So I have to talk